Hi, everybody. I'm Ted Price from Insomniac Games. On this episode of The Game Maker's Notebook, my guest is Kiki Wolfkill. She's the studio head of Halo Transmedia Entertainment at 343 Industries. She has an awesome job as she bridges the gap between games and traditional media, bringing Halo to an entirely new audience. We talked about her unique history, including her career as a race car driver, what transmedia really means, and the importance of diversity in our industry.
Welcome to The Game Maker's Notebook, a podcast featuring a series of in-depth one-on-one conversations between game makers providing a thoughtful, intimate perspective on the business and craft of interactive entertainment. The Game Maker's Notebook is presented by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, a member-driven organization dedicated to the recognition and advancement of interactive entertainment.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, it's awesome having you on.
Yeah, and what a setting, right?
We are here. That's right. We're here in Las Vegas looking out at a beautiful view of the Strip. A little cloudy today.
It is a little cloudy. It's been cold, but The energy level here is great.
Indeed. Well, you say cold. Now, you're from Washington. You live in Washington, so this
That's
is nothing
true.
Compared
There's
to Washington.
There's no snow here as there is in Seattle right now, but it's a little cooler than I'd expect. I'm wearing a jacket.
Right. That is unusual for a Washington native whose blood is probably much thicker than our Southern California.
Your tender Southern California bloodstream, yes.
And just mentioning Washington, one of the connections you and I have is University of Washington.
Yes.
I have a daughter who goes there, and you are an alumnus of University
That's right.
of Washington.
I went to University of Washington. I went to the Jackson School of International Studies there, which prepared me well for a career in video games.
Now, you say that somewhat facetiously.
Yeah, it didn't at all. I was a Chinese history major. However, I went back to start a second degree in broadcast journalism because I wanted to make documentary films. So I learned how to shoot and edit at the time with traditional tape, which then got me into digital editing and effects work, and then games. So it's all very serendipitous and unplanned.
That's cool. So when you say effects work, you're talking about effects work for traditional media?
Yeah. I'll age myself and say that I got into digital video, and it was lucky because it was early, so it was kind of a black art. So if you were just persistent, you could sort of break in. And was doing... got into Avid editing and Flint and Flame compositing and effects, mostly for cinematics, and started doing it for games at Microsoft. And that was sort of my entree into video gaming.
So back then, were you taking real footage of, say, explosions and flames and then compositing them in games or creating sprites?
There was some of that. So there was some sprite, you're going to laugh at this. There was some like 8-bit sprite work for our golf game. So compositing, yes, real humans who were then put into 8-bit form and then composited into the virtual golf spaces.
I think that's super cool. I mean, that's working within a certain constraint that games had at the time, right?
That's right. And that was actually what was so exciting for me. I'd always played games, didn't really realize that they were made by people and companies. I don't know where I thought they came from. Someone needed to educate me. But when I started to get, I'd had an art background as well. And so when I started to get into the digital editing and effects work and doing work on games, the technical challenges were so interesting. Like, it was a whole different kind of creative problem solving. And even working with those crazy 256 color palettes was, and making something look as real, like a character as real as possible with those constraints was just, I found it really compelling. And also being on sort of the cutting edge of technology, right? Well, film was on the cutting edge of graphics technology, but real time for us, always being on that edge and that landscape always changing and the nature of the challenges always changing and, you know, this sort of constant push for incremental improvement and fidelity was really compelling for me.
What was the first game that you released?
The very first game I believe that I worked on was Kart Precision Racing, IndyCar Simulator PC game.
And were you doing the effects on that?
Yeah, so I was doing the 2D animations for their racing school, but ironically, I was also racing cars at the time because I, long story, but I'd grown up around motorsports. And I was also an instructor at the local, you know, racing school. And so the Kart Precision Racing team had called the racing school and said, hey, we need a subject matter expert to work on the racing school section. Do you know anyone? And they said, well, there actually is someone who is, there's an artist over in the production studio. And so I was subject matter expert for the racing school.
That's incredible.
Yeah, which an incredible set of coincidences and opportunities. And I was contract artist, and then ended up joining Microsoft Game Studios full-time as an artist and art lead.
Well, I just have to ask, do you still race cars?
So I still drive on the track. I don't competitively race, formally, I should say. I race a lot on the street. But yeah, I raced amateur for, I think, about 6 years, and pro for about 6 years after that. It's always been part of my life. I love driving. I love driving fast. I took a break, actually, when I joined 343, because I just didn't have any time for it. And just recently got a new track car and got back on the track, and it's been amazing.
What is a track car, for those of us who don't know anything about racing?
So it's, I should say it's a track-optimized car. So it's a Porsche GT4, which is, they design their GT cars more for track, meaning they're more sparse, right?
Okay.
I don't have heated seats. I don't have cruise control. I drive it on the street all the time because I love driving it.
Does it have roll
bars?
They're
a little bit lighter. No, this does not have roll bars.
I only ask that because it's about the only technical term I know when
it
comes to racing cars.
Well, it's when I first started racing as a struggling racer, my street car and my race car were the same. So I used to have a car that had a full roll cage in it, racing seats. Getting in and out of that in a skirt was nightmarish.
So you're driving to work in
this car? It was super loud. It was so uncomfortable, right, because of the suspension.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. And ironically, there was a freak accident and a tree split in half and landed on that car. But because I had the full cage, it was actually, aside from some suspension,
it survived,
breaking.
Or you survived from it.
Well,
were you
I was
in the
not
car?
In it, but,
okay.
But the car survived to race another day. Yeah.
Did you bring anything from your racing experience over into games?
Yeah. I mean, I think in a few different ways. I would say, from a sort of my own ability to sort of navigate chaos with focus and calmness, I think, is something that probably I built some muscle around driving. You know, sort of letting the chaos happen and being able to focus on the right priorities and not let sort of the stress of a crazy situation impact my judgment was something that I think I take away from that experience. And then also, you know, environmentally, especially back in the like 90s and 2000s, it culturally wasn't very different in terms of both environments being really male oriented. Mm. And I think for me, being able to be, to sort of navigate that gracefully and sort of keep my focus on the things that were important and not letting that noise be a distraction was a good thing. I think today I look at it very differently because the noise isn't just a distraction. It's something we need to address. Okay. So I think I spent a lot of time sort of tuning things out that now I feel are really important for me to pay attention to try and help improve.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. What are some examples of the kind of noise that we need to tackle?
Yeah. And, you know, it's amazing because the environment, even in the last 6 months, is so different. And there's such a good intent to improve, I think, from certainly from our company, but also I think the industry as a whole. But, you know, it was not unusual at all to be the only woman in the room all the time. And, you know, same with at the racetrack. And at the racetrack, I would say people were even more sort of brazen with their commentary around being the only female out there and whether you should be there or not, or expressing their disgust at being beaten by a woman, which was extraordinary. That was a lot more sort of explicit, because I think that kind of environment is just sort of more emotional and unguarded. And competition doesn't always bring out the best in people. But I think in the game industry, it was the same. Like, they're just, you know, I got used to being in an environment where there weren't a lot of other women to talk to. And I would say I was really fortunate, because even coming up, you know, I came up at Microsoft and Xbox with Bonnie Ross and with Shannon Loftus and with these incredible other women, and we were sort of each other's pack. And a lot of people didn't have that opportunity. And so I think today there is an understanding of the importance of inclusion for humanity reasons and the importance of inclusion for business reasons. And I think it's a hard time because it's so hard to navigate, and it's scary to navigate and feel like you're walking on eggshells and wondering if what you're saying is okay or not. But that's sort of the pain you have to go through to come out on the other side and have a better workplace culture.
Where do you see people walking on eggshells?
I think that where it comes from is, and I will even say this for myself, because I'm not always like, I have a potty mouth. I'm really expressive. And I think there's a lot of nuance in terms of what it means to be in a room and making sure that everyone feels comfortable with different communication styles. And it's not just the really sort of explicit bias, right? Like, that's sort of the easier thing to curb. It's that in order to create a really inclusive environment, it is about inviting different perspectives and also accepting that someone may not like harsh language or may not, you know, appreciate like a really loud voice or like any number of things. And for me, I've had to sort of take a step back and make sure that, you know, me in the past where I might have, I'll be super open here, where I might have been like, that person's being a dick, right? And that's just not right, you know? And that causes a lot of self-reflection, and that's scary, right? And I think for a lot of people, sort of treading that ground feels really intimidating, and they don't want to do the wrong thing. And so then it causes just sort of a little bit of a stepping back. And I think we all have to be comfortable with, we're all trying to figure this out together.
Yeah.
And it's okay for us to make wrong moves, and it's okay to be corrected in a graceful, constructive way. And that's not a bad thing. That's just how we all get better. But it's new ground.
How do you set ground rules then for, say, groups of people who are coming together for the first time to work on a project, and you have a very specific idea for how you want to make inclusion possible, mm-hmm. or have a common language that's not going to offend people? Are there techniques you use?
Yeah. And I think that's where it's hard, because you don't want to set such rigid groundwork that isn't necessarily inclusive either. It's how do we come together and let's be respectful of each other. Let's be respectful of each other's styles. And if someone doesn't feel comfortable with something, be comfortable saying that and be gracious and comfortable getting that feedback. Right, because it's organic. You sort of have to figure out as you go along, you know, what is the right balance of all of those things, because you don't want to dull everyone's personality either.
Yeah.
Right, and that's the tricky balance.
Do you find yourself getting involved and solving interpersonal conflicts on the teams that you lead?
Yeah, and I think that's normal, and I think especially in the game industry. So much of what we do feels so personal, and our teams feel really personal. You know, we invest so much time and emotional energy into the things that we're creating that the idea of you just show up at work, you do your thing, and you leave, and you're respectful of your peers, and everyone does the thing they need to. I think it's different for us because we are sort of family. Like, we're in the trenches together. We are going through trials and tribulations together. And so I think that, you know, in that family sense, you do have to figure out these things as you go along. And the interpersonal stuff is really important, right? I find that in the past on different teams, sometimes it's a mediation role. Sometimes it's helping two people communicate with each other who just have different styles. But I think we need an environment where people feel comfortable coming and saying, I'm having challenges with this person or that person, or we're struggling to work together, or, you know, we have to be able to work through those.
How do you get to know the people on your teams really well so that you can sort of anticipate those problems or at least deal with them in a way that works for them?
Yeah. I mean, I think part of it is encouraging your teams to show up as sort of their authentic self. And that's and that's part of creating that inclusivity in the environment where people feel comfortable doing that, right? So that when they're in a meeting room and they're having conversations, they are showing up as who they are, and, you know, their beliefs and the things they're passionate about are expressed. You know, I will say early in my career, I kept my work and my personal life really separate. Like I felt like I needed my work persona. And I, you know, part of that I think was a defensive mechanism. Again, sort of being one of just a few women. But I soon learned as I started to step into more team leadership roles that I needed to be more of who I was. I needed to show more of my personal self and include them in my life and talk about, you know, my family and things happening at home or the things I was doing or my weekend, because that's the kind of bond we needed together, especially when we were going to battle together. And so I think fostering that sense of, you know, not asking people to share things they're not comfortable with, but we should have a level of understanding of each other where we empathize with each other and we connect with each other is more than just the role that someone's playing.
I think that's really, that's excellent advice. It is hard as a leader to sort of let down your barriers and allow people to see what you're really like at outside of work and talk about your interests.
Yeah.
I just personally feel like that, but I think that's anybody who's a leader should be considering that and doing it more frequently.
Yeah, because that encourages that same culture of, you know, we have to have each other's back through this, right? And so having a level of understanding of what makes a person tick, what excites them, and just having that personal connection means, A, when there is conflict, hopefully you come into it assuming that their intentions are good and wanting to assume the right things about the conflict, as opposed to, you know, in a vacuum of understanding who someone is, you tend to jump to the worst conclusion versus the better conclusion.
Yeah, that's a great point. So in leading teams at 343, talk if you don't mind, talk about how you went from creating effects early on to actually becoming the team leader for Transmedia at 343.
Yeah. I mean, I will say I feel lucky in that I have had great opportunities come up. I will say I've also always been very quick to take them and also make good on them as much as possible, even just moving into games, which hadn't been a career path I would have thought I'd been on. But once I was in it, could not leave. So I came up then through the art side. So I was the art lead for a lot of our racing and simulation games early on. So pre-Xbox, PC, Monster Truck Madness.
I remember that one.
Yeah, Monster Truck Madness 2, Motocross Madness, Shannon and myself, and a very good friend of ours who's now heads up YouTube Gaming, and one other woman. We were the Ladies of Madness.
Was that your internal moniker, or did everybody in the studio know you as?
Oh no, we were the yeah.
Why was it Madness?
We may have started it because of all the we worked on the Motocross Madness Monster Truck. Yeah.
Was there some
Midtown
other
Midtown Madness?
Well, were there any other characteristics ascribed to you that related to the madness?
You know, I would say that we were all. We were all very, I would say, not outspoken. We were all very comfortable with expressing ourselves. We had fun together. When you're working on games like that, you have to have fun. Our morale events were a thing to behold. So
what was the craziest morale event?
Oh my gosh. So when we, worked on, I think it was Midtown Madness 2, maybe. I hate that it's either 1 or 2. I think it was 2. We worked with Angel Studios in San Diego.
Yeah.
And so we ended up having our ship party in San Diego. I don't think we could have a morale ship party like this again. Angel Studios brought in a case of tequila and we rented out this amazing bar. And it was great because it was kind of a hard production cycle. And someone had brilliantly, I may blame this on Shannon, someone had brilliantly decided that we were going to do the postmortem for the project. And the teams at that point were a little contentious. Everyone was fried. We're going to do the postmortem for the project the day after.
After a case of tequila.
After our ship party and a case of tequila, which we did finish off. And it was probably the best thing that happened because we of course bonded over the case of tequila. We all rolled into the postmortem a little bit unwell and yet bonded in a different way. And, you know, then you remember why you were partners in the first place. You know, so in talking through real postmortem issues, the emotional intensity of those conversations was dropped a lot lower. I won't go into specifics of the ship party though, but it was fantastic. So after that, Xbox came along and it was such an interesting transition for us coming from PC gaming, because it wasn't just the shift of designing for Xbox and understanding what a console game is and developing for console and working with console partners. It was also a shift for gaming at Microsoft in terms of really understanding that content needed to be a priority, which it's ironic to say now, but at the time, PC gaming for Microsoft was all about sort of driving DirectX and driving Windows as a developer platform. But not about being the best experience on PC, but hey, look, we do these games, you can create games in Windows as well. Obviously with Xbox, it was a whole different story. It was, we need to define a bar and what's capable on the console to bring other developers onto the platform and players. But obviously early on it was about bringing partners on because we were such an unknown. And at the same time, I was doing a lot of work internally to really try and advocate for the art discipline, because you're a huge software company that made Excel and Word and SQL Server, and the idea of creating content and art in particular, an equal challenge for game design and audio, was just a language and a culture that the broader corporate company didn't understand.
Yeah.
And so I was doing a lot of work internally to build out like the art laddering and levels to make sure that we were compensating artists well enough. At the same time with the shift to Xbox was the amount we need to invest in content, and the quality and fidelity of that content needed to be so high. And it was a big cultural shift in the company, but a really exciting challenge. And so I went on from there to be the art director for the racing studio. And then that sort of broadened to working on games like Mass Effect and Gears. And again, Bonnie was there heading up production through that period. I was on the art side, as well as on the racing side, the Project Gotham Racing series, starting up the Forza team, which is now Turn 10 and an extraordinary studio relative to the humble beginnings. Ultimately ended up as the director of art for all of Microsoft Studios. And I think what happened was during that period, I tended to really get energized and express some different strengths, particularly in sort of the end game of a project. And I'd always sort of had a good foot in production as well as in creative. and so was able to both sort of bridge conversations across creative and production, but also really help problem solve and really think about how do we maintain this vision while solving around our production and technical constraints, and particularly in this sort of high intensity atmosphere of shipping. And so at the time, Shane Kim was running Xbox, and you know, probably about 6 months before sort of the Bungie spinoff and doing a reorganization and creating 343, he'd asked me to move into an executive producer role and a cross-discipline leadership role, which was really exciting for me because a whole different kind of challenge creatively and from a leadership perspective. And I at the time I said I would love that, but I have some more work to do here on the art side, which was really kind of seeing through that from an HR perspective, that artist career development structure and plan. And so after that work was complete, it was right around the time they were doing this reorganization, and you know, there was an opportunity to join what would then become Turn 10. As an executive producer, and then Bonnie came and talked to me about a role on 343 as she was putting that studio together. And on the one hand, I love racing games. I have a lot of experience there, but I really loved Halo, and I loved storytelling, and I loved the universe and the IP, and the opportunity to really dig into that was extraordinary. So that's when I joined 343, which I guess was probably 2008.
Halo 2 time period?
So this would have been as Halo 3 ODST was being developed.
Okay.
And so they were working on Halo 3. Bungie was working on Halo 3 ODST and Halo Reach at the same time. And when I was director of art for Microsoft Studios, I actually worked with Bungie a lot on Halo 3. Okay. In particular, and with Marcus Lehto at the time. But yeah, at this point, what we had decided was... Bungie's going to finish Reach, the next Halo, not called Halo 4 at the time. We didn't know what it would be, but really the successor to Halo 3 was kind of up in the air with what we would do there. At the same time, we were working on a concept with Peter Jackson potentially about a Halo game. And so that's actually what I was brought on for.
And to then, work with him and his team to figure out what it was going to be?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was something that Bungie had been working on in the past. And ultimately, we ended up deciding that the studio really needed to focus on the next shooter, the next big Halo game. And so I started building up the Halo 4 team basically we built Halo 4, which was an extraordinary experience. And I can't even begin to express the depth and breadth of learning for me of that experience. And then after Halo 4 shipped, really started to shift more into transmedia. And I will say that we always had a vision, and Bonnie always had a vision of Halo as a Star Wars, in terms of the kind of emotional connection and loyalty to the universe that people could have. So there was always a North Star of Halo as a cultural touchstone, but we had business to attend to, which was getting Halo 4 done. And so it was really after that that we were able to be a little more focused and deliberate about what that would mean. What does it mean to grow our universe, and how do we be deliberate about it? Because we'd had books and comics and fleece jammies and all sorts of
good of books, things. By the way. I remember reading the Halo books. Were entertaining.
So,
very entertaining.
Sidebar on that, when Halo CE, when Halo Combat Evolved first came out, they gave it to us a day or two early, and they gave us Halo, The Fall of Reach, the book. And I was like, oh my God, like I'm going to read this book. and then stayed up all night playing Combat Evolved. And that was such an extraordinary experience for me. I loved that game. I loved how much part of that story I felt, mm-hmm. and how I felt as Master Chief. And I finished that game and I literally just wanted more.
Yeah.
And I turned around and the book was there. And I read the book, and after the book, I was completely hooked because it gave me just a really different understanding of Master Chief and John and what the game was built upon. And so that's what brought me into the universe, and I didn't want to leave after that.
So if we encountered hostile aliens someday, would you sign up as a Spartan?
Yes, actually, I think I probably would.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And with your racing background
and
team leadership skills, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
We would need Spartans like you.
Yes, I would be in.
Do you believe aliens exist?
I have no reason not to.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
Like
this.
Why wouldn't you believe? Like there's in a gap of data, it seems harder to disprove than it would be to prove.
I'm totally with you on that. Yeah. I bet our industry feels, for the most part, the same way.
Like, why not? But I also believe in ghosts, so.
Fair enough, right?
Yes.
And that's the same issue, right?
Yeah.
Hard to disprove it.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry for that sidestep.
No.
But I just had to ask you because
yeah.
I, after reading those books and experiencing the Halo universe, which I think was hugely influential for us at Insomniac
mm-hmm.
as we were building shooters, it's a compelling story, and it kind of makes you think, you know, outside of the sci-fi trappings, what would you do when faced with sort of a global catastrophe like that?
Yeah.
Would you sign up? Would you,
yeah.
would you go for it? Would you be a leader?
Yeah. And there's something so simple about the stakes, which is, I think what makes it so relatable. It's like humanity is at stake.
Yeah.
Like everything that we hold dear is at stake. And I think underlying that is the idea that we are worth saving. Like, I think that nuance is important, right? It's not just that everything's at stake, it's that we should fight for ourselves, not just out of selfishness, but because our humankind is something that is worth saving.
That's a great, I believe that may be a theme that's often missed by
mm-hmm.
players, but it absolutely, I feel like it goes throughout the series.
Yeah.
And would you say that's part of the sort of the heart and soul of Halo you're bringing over into Transmedia?
Yeah, it is. And it's, you know, it's funny because the simplicity of that, you know, against a rich sort of complex backdrop, but the simplicity of that, I think, is what makes it so easy to connect to from a game perspective. It also makes it an interesting challenge as you go into other mediums and is something in particular, you know, with the television show and the complexity of storytelling that premium cable and television brings, it's been a learning experience in terms of deconstructing our own stories and universe to understand how to carry that forward in that particular medium. I think in books, it's a little easier because you have a captive audience and you have an audience that loves sci-fi, and getting deep into sci-fi details or that sci-fi backdrop is a little more straightforward. When you start getting into a television show where you have to really grab people right away and take them on a long journey of storytelling, it's really different. And to get back to your question first, you know, when we think about the IP, like there's all the trappings of canon, right? There's the assault rifle and plasma and the, you know, different Covenant enemies. There's like all of the proper names that come with Halo. And then there's all the history, the dates and what happened when. And most people have no idea what those things are. And in fact, we have deep history where maybe an event has been referenced once in a sentence in a comic somewhere. But for us, that history is alive and chronicled and real. But I think more importantly, there's sort of our brand pillars and what we call our beliefs, which are sort of the thematic elements that are part of that core DNA and really anchor Halo with our players and viewers and fans, and hopefully are the things that we carry forward regardless of what we do, whatever the form factor is, whatever time period it is. Hopefully we're embodying those beliefs. And that's something we really try and communicate with our partners. But it is that sense of hope,
mm-hmm.
right? It's a dark story. It's a very dark story and dark universe. And it's important that there is that sense of maybe we can prevail and maybe there is always that light at the end of the tunnel, and we have to have sort of those moments of light and levity so that we can contrast the dark moments in the story and events. But that piece is always important for us. As dark as it is, we're going to keep fighting because we think there's a tiny chance in hell we may win, and that's still worth fighting for. Wonder and mystery, like, it's a sci-fi universe. We want people to feel like you want to see, whether you have anxiety and it's a little scary, you want people to see around the next corner and explore and have those moments of coming out of the bumblebee and stepping out into the world and seeing that halo ring and feeling awe and wonder. Like, that's the kind of sci-fi that we are. We're not sterile, polished, super high-tech sci-fi where these worlds people have never seen and creatures you've never seen. And, you know, for me, that's a big draw. I love that sense of mystery, and I love the curiosity it sparks in me.
Are most of the people you're working with on the series mm-hmm. Halo players?
It's a mix, which is good, right? Because we drink a lot of our own Kool-Aid,
yeah.
And it's delicious. So so we need people coming in, right, from not just who have deep expertise in other areas, but who also don't come with all of those deep-seated notions already of what Halo needs to be.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's even hard for us to be objective about it and to let go of things that we feel are really critical, but at the end of the day, actually aren't the thing that make Halo what it is. And that's sort of a moment-to-moment process to filter and understand. And so we do have some number of people who have experience, and it may be that their experience is they've always played the game. It may be that they, you know, they've read all the books and they really are the sort of deep canon fans. But for us, we do a lot of education. So we'll do big boot camps, not just to explain all the proper names of, you know, this is what a plasma grenade is, but also to explain, you know, here's the nature of Chief and Cortana's relationship, right? Here's the whole history of them together. And also here's how players have experienced them. Because I think the thing that's been so unique about this TV adaptation process is we have to take a look at the characters, and, you know, we can use John as an example. Part of what every player understands about Master Chief is what they've heard or seen in the games, in cinematics, and how other characters talk about him. The other half of what they understand about him is what they themselves have put into him as a player. And so that becomes a really complex challenge as you think about translating that to screen. And, to, you know, for the TV show, we want our audience to come to that. We also want to bring in, you know, the people on the couch next to you who've watched you play Halo and never quite understood why you loved Halo. We want to bring sort of your broader circle into the TV show, and people who maybe would never engage with Halo as a video game, bring them into the universe. And so how do you take a character like Master Chief and sort of fully develop him and have his character arc be something deep and interesting when everyone has a different understanding of who he is? And so you have to be respectful of who he is, carry his character forward in ways that are very different from the game, and try not to disrespect everyone's personal view of who that character is. And that's a really tough challenge that we're navigating right now.
Okay.
And it's one of those things where there's no clear answer.
Yeah.
And part of that is what's really exciting to me, which is there has certainly been financial success in video game adaptations, but it's hard for someone to say there's just been a, you know, knock it out of the park, great video game adaptation. I feel like I understand why now. Hmm. It's so hard. And my instinct is to keep hanging on to things as we know them. And we have such talent on the television side who's writing amazing television. And in letting go of some of those things, it's been really amazing to watch the story come to life in such a compelling way. And being okay with some of those differences in character or how very specific events of canon are dealt with, but make for a great story and still adhere to the spirit of Halo has been really interesting.
And how, I guess, what I hear you saying too is that you're balancing what you know fans love about the series with surprising them, but also being true to the medium of television, right?
Yeah.
Because it's different. I mean, completely different.
It is. And what we've committed to in partnering with Showtime and, you know, wanting to be premium cable is really character-driven drama against extraordinary Halo world building.
Yeah.
Right? Because this is a huge, you know, it's a big budget, high fidelity story. And, you know, the video games develop characters differently.
Yeah.
And again, part of the design of characters is so players can invest their own, you know, sort of personalities and beliefs into those characters. And so when you take that piece out of it, it's risky and also exciting.
Do you find other shows inspirational as you make this shift away from games into television?
Yeah. I mean,
Or any other sort of non-gaming
yeah.
Pieces of work.
Yeah, it's hard to find an analog. You know, we talk about Game of Thrones a lot in terms of sort of scope and scale and complexity of relationships. Because it's funny, because a lot of the background of Halo is this sort of political drama, right? And it's something that you touch on really lightly in the games and see more deeply in some of the other mediums. And so I think in something like a Game of Thrones, some of that complexity is interesting. No incest planned at all for this show.
Good to know.
I'll say that. Yeah. Yeah. If you're looking for that, you won't find it here.
And to be clear, I'm absolutely not asking, are you guys patterning your show on something
that
exists? I'm more interested in your personal interest. When you are relaxing and not playing games, what are the shows that really attract you in terms of their drama, characters, world building? I mean, Game of Thrones is a great example.
Right? Yeah, so I'm a huge fan of Game of Thrones. And I read all the books before I started watching the show. I really admired how they adapted. You know, they stayed very close to the books before they started branching away. The thing I always admired about those first two seasons when they were more closely coupled was when there was a shift, you could understand exactly why, because it was such a great story. So it never felt like there was a change for change's sake.
Yeah.
It always felt like it was in service of better storytelling. And that's something we for sure aspire to. I think our challenges are a little bit different coming from game versus book, where I think it's a little easier to be literal with the book. You know, I think I watch a lot of different TV. I love Westworld, even though, frankly, a lot of the Westworld storytelling happens in the conversations after the show. I kind of enjoy that aspect of it. The visualizations of Westworld are amazing. We do look to a lot of the old sci-fi, old and existing, right? Because there's tonally so much that's different out there. If you look at The Expanse or Star Trek or Battlestar Galactica, you know, we try and calibrate a little bit, and I think this will feel really different from those, partially because it really is a big investment from a visual perspective. Altered Carbon would be another one. Like, we're really intrigued with sort of the sci-fi offerings out there. I don't know. I feel like we will have a unique space in there.
You are, at least from my perspective, going to do something that very few, if any, game IPs have done successfully. And it seems like the industry has tried very hard over the last 25 years to make a crossover that really sticks the landing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I understand now why it's so hard. I feel like part of what's so exciting for me about this is I want to crack that nut so badly, right? I hate it. I hate it when people say, oh, you can't do that. You can't make a movie or a TV show out of a video game. No one's ever done it. Like, they're always bad. It's like, well, it's not because you can't. It's because it's a really hard challenge and everyone's still trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
Right? But there isn't something inherent in the format of video games that makes it impossible to adapt. It is just it's a hard challenge. And like I said, literally day to day, we are making decisions on what can change, what shouldn't change, what can we bend. And we are putting a lot of our trust in our TV partners. Like, you have to be humble and recognize that the expertise you're bringing is different from the expertise that they have. And you have to be able to take that leap of faith and trust that the things that they want and are lobbying for and need are the right things. That's probably the hardest part, is that leap of faith.
But great words of wisdom. I think if we look back at some of the more high-profile failures in our industry when it comes to moving to traditional mediums, that's kind of where we've gotten in our own way, assuming that we are experts in that other medium. When the case is,
hey,
people have been working, doing that for 30 years, 20, 30, 25 years.
Yeah.
And they are experts, and we need to trust their judgment.
Yeah. Even if you've been reading about it for 30 years, it's not having been doing it for 30 years. In the same way, we certainly wouldn't expect a TV writer to come in and just go ahead and make a video game better than we could, although you never know. But yeah, so that's been really interesting, and I think we've been fortunate. This process has been really long. You know, we've been talking to Showtime and working with Showtime for 5 years to get this off the ground, which has really been a struggle at times, because it's not the fun part when you're in that 5 years. That's like contracts and finding people, and it's not sort of the creative juice of it. And we went through some talent changes. But what I will say is we've landed in a place where we have such a strong partnership with Showtime and with the team. And I think that there is a great mutual respect. And if we come out of it on the other side and it's not everything we wanted it to be, I will say for sure that we went about it the right way in terms of the partnership and the collaboration. And I have no doubts that we will have moved the medium forward in some way, you know, whether it gets us ultimately to where we want to go. I do feel we will move that ball forward in some way. But today I would say my hope is, like I said, we crack that nut and create something that brings the universe to life in a different way. And brings a video game to life in a different way. And I think there's a mutual respect from an audience perspective that I hope happens from that as well.
Well, I think the time is perfect, right? Yeah. It does seem, in terms of audience, there is so much crossover. We have people who are playing games more or as much as watching TV, vice versa. And that's the whole current gamer generations.
Yeah.
I feel like treat both equally versus when you and I got into the industry. Yeah. It was a lot different.
Oh yeah.
And so I absolutely applaud what you and 343 are doing, and I think it's going to be a huge win for the industry.
I hope so. It's creatively incredibly exciting and incredibly stressful.
Yeah.
Like, it just you know, it's hard to understand when you're being too protective and stifling the creativity on the other side of the fence, that you need to let have some more space and room.
But a constant challenge. I mean, that sounds so just to ask a couple final questions. Mm-hmm. You have a fantastic and super interesting background in terms of how you got into the industry. And I know a lot of people who listen to this podcast either are in the industry. Many are in the industry, but we have a lot of folks who are listening who want to go into the industry. What advice would you have for them, especially women who are perhaps thinking about pursuing degrees that would lead them to our industry?
Yeah. I mean, I would say, you know, it's interesting because I had a liberal arts education. I always studied art. And obviously my entry into the industry was through art. And at the time I didn't really understand. I thought because I was creative, and frankly, I was told this all through school, because you're creative, you're not a math or science person.
Wow.
Right? Like you're just kind of
Ouch.
Bucketed. Right. And so I kind of grew up believing, oh, I hate math and science. Right. And I think what I ended up loving about coming into the game industry and starting to work in the digital space is I discovered that they weren't mutually exclusive. And the kind of creativity that was unleashed when I suddenly had all these digital tools was far beyond anything I could have done traditionally. And that was so empowering. And I think of myself as someone who is firmly in the technology space, right? Which I never would have thought I would have been in before. And so in terms of career, you know, creativity isn't something that has to be sort of siloed in its on its own path. Every single person on the team is creative, whether you're a programmer or a tester or a producer. And so it kind of goes both ways. STEM is an area where you can be incredibly creative and be challenged as a creative in ways that you never really thought about before. And alternatively, you know, you can be a programmer and think about your job as creative. And so just in terms of women coming into the industry, I would just think very openly about, you know, STEM can empower you to choose what you want to do. And I think that was the thing I wish I had learned earlier, so I hadn't fallen into the job that I did. But I think for anyone trying to come into the industry, just start making things. Find game jams, find the meetups, find the community of game developers where you are, because there's so many and it's so welcoming. And actually making the content and getting the experience of working with a team and collaborating, because it's those soft skills of collaboration and problem solving together that make someone effective in the role and that give you experiences that you can put on your resume and talk about in an interview that isn't just the curriculum you learned, right? It's the pieces that actually make teams run. And the more you can build with other people, the more you have to show and the more you can talk with experience about what it is to make a game versus just what you've studied in school before.
That is such great advice.
Thanks.
So if people have questions for you, do you mind sharing your Twitter handle?
Yeah, not at all. It's just K_Wolfkill. It's very straightforward.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I am happy to talk game development anytime, getting into the industry, certainly transmedia. I'm really passionate about sort of what it means to express a universe in different ways and let people into a universe in different ways and finding ways to really build connection with players and viewers and, you know, something that goes beyond, I'm going to play through this game and put it down. I want that lifelong love. I want it, you know, to be something you want to share with your friends and family. And so I love thinking about what are those stories and play mechanics that that really grab people and don't let go of them.
That's awesome. Thank you, Kiki.
Yeah, it's so good to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us for the Game Maker's Notebook. For more information on the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, our podcasts, and our other initiatives, please visit www.interactive.org.